You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
All right, folks. Welcome back to the Break It Down Podcast. Hope you guys are enjoying this spell of content, this role I'm on now. I've had some really good episodes. The Kevin Lyman one last week was awesome. People seem to love that, and I had a great time doing it. Really kind of having fun doing these one-on-ones and actually getting time to spend talking to people. I'm not even sure that I'm good at it yet or anything like that, but I'm laser beaming on the notion of it. I think of how good I'll be at this in 10 years. I think I'll be really good in 10 or 15 years at this. And I mean that seriously. It's just I enjoy doing this just for the learning and the skills part of it alone, not to mention getting to share stuff with you guys and doing other stuff. So what we're going to do now is I'm going to do this kind of mini series on producers. I've got two or three, four really cool producers lined up to talk to who have done records that I really like a ton. And so starting with this episode here, I've got Mark Trombino. I'm going to talk to him just in a few minutes. And Mark recorded almost all of Jimmy Eat World stuff, if not all of their stuff, including Clarity, which is one of my favorite records of all time. He recorded Mineral, Starting Line, Finch, Blink 182, Mock Orange, Motion City Soundtrack, Silverstein, All Time Low. He's been doing this for a really long time. He was a drummer in a band called Drive Like Jehu. And Mark now is doing less producing, and he's doing a donut shop. He has a donut shop called Donut Friend in Los Angeles, where he lives. So quite interesting. Going to talk to him about all that stuff. Thank you for supporting this podcast, especially those of you who have been doing it on Amazon. That's really easy. It's a really fair, simple way that you can support this podcast. It doesn't cost you anything. So all you got to do is go to my website, go to breakitdownpod.com, click the Amazon link there, and then bookmark it. And then anytime you buy anything on Amazon, without even thinking about it, without even knowing it, you'll be supporting this podcast. I now get checks every month for some dollars, and it really does help, and it really does motivate me and makes me know that you care. And it doesn't cost you anything if you're an Amazon shopper. Also, I'm very thankful for the people that choose to actually pay money, believe it or not, for this podcast that I do. Yes, it's free, but also you could choose to pay for it. And I would just suggest that if you do, you might even enjoy it a little bit more. So thank you for doing that. The money that I can make from this podcast, as it accumulates, I will continue to put towards my daughter Georgia's childcare. That's the original idea I've had for this. And it still doesn't make enough money monthly to pay for a nanny or her preschool or anything like that. But if it does, that I'll let you know. And then we'll make a new plan from that. But thank you to the people that do contribute to that. It does mean a lot. All right, here we go. Let's talk to Mark.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down.
Hey, hey, hey. Mark, how's it going, buddy?
Hey, good. How are you?
Where are you right now? It's an interesting looking background there. Way better than most people's bedroom webcams.
Yeah, I'm at home, actually. So,
what is that, a basement?
No, it's like a, it's just a...
Sorry to poke around your house, but it's really... Oh, the ceiling's just amazing, though.
Yeah. It's like a loft. I live downtown LA.
Oh, that's awesome.
Where are you at right now?
I'm in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Seattle. I know I don't sound like it, which is what throws people off typically, because I travel all the time, tell people I'm from Seattle all the time, and they just don't. They say, "That's you didn't understand my question," I don't think, is what they say. But I'm from South Carolina originally.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So,
are you in your studio right now? Or?
No, I'm using a shared workspace downtown in Seattle, which works great because I try to get out of the house. So I had to lug a little bit of equipment and, you know, get downtown. But I have stuff's expensive in Seattle. I've got a real small house. I don't even have a spare room right now. So I can do this in the kitchen, but there's likely to be a kid or a wife or somebody go through at some point, and it's very distracting. So
yeah. Okay.
So I love to get out and come down here to the shared workspace and do that. So
cool.
Do you do? Have you done much podcasting, like done with other people? I've heard, I've seen you, we're on and heard, listened to a little bit of that one of you did with Jonah Ray. I saw that was a while back probably though.
Yeah, that was a weird one. I did one, I think one other like Skype one that I think went really well. That was fun.
Why was that weird with Jonah Ray?
Because my mic was so odd. Like I was sitting in a room with like six other people.
Uh-huh.
Like this is fine. One-on-one is so different than, I'm just not good in groups, whatever.
Really?
So I was like in a room with six people, six comedians, you know, and I just was like, so like nervous and scared. And plus then my mic was like so much like quieter than everyone else's. And it was fun because I love those guys, but I was just so scared the whole time.
Well, I thought it's interesting because comedians are supposed to be really good at making it go smoothly and making you comfortable. But I guess on the other end, it's intimidating kind of a thing.
So intimidating. Just, like if it was just me and Jonah or just me and a couple guys, it would have been probably fine. But like, it was
weird.
A lot of people there. Yeah.
Because the podcasters have all kind of different strategies for making it comfortable. Because for him, he's way more comfortable having his buddies or hanging around and laughing. So he thinks that makes the show good. But from your point of view, you're better off to do a one-on-one.
Yeah.
Interesting. Are you like an introvert or extrovert, or do you like media in general? Like, how do you relate to that stuff?
I'm an introvert for sure. Yeah.
I don't know if that relates. I guess that's two questions. One is, are you an introverted guy that or extrovert likes to talk? And then secondly, how do you personally... How traditionally have you ever always felt about doing media and interviews and stuff like that? Have you enjoyed it or you don't like it?
I do. I like conversations. I like talking to people for sure. But, rarely do I get, like even in my time with Drive Like Joe, I was never the guy that people came to for interviews or whatever. And if it was an interview, it'd be like all of us, the four of us or whatever being interviewed by somebody. And then I just get sort of overshadowed by everyone, you know? Which is fine. I've always been the guy in a group, like just quietly sitting there watching everybody else. I'm not in the spotlight kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, about though, like just that through your producing career, even with people wanting to do press interviews? I mean, certainly people have for the local this or this small webzine or for Absolute Punk or things like that. Have people always wanted to interview you to that? And did you always say yes, or do you don't see the point in doing those things?
I usually say yes if people ask. A lot of times they're like email interviews, which are good and bad because I end up spending a lot of time on those.
I'm almost on a pretty strict no policy entirely with email interviews for that reason because I'll talk to anybody on the phone, give them 15 minutes. That's how I say yes, no matter what. But if I've got to get on there and type an email, then I have to make it excellent.
Yeah.
And even if the questions aren't good, or I think nobody's ever going to see this thing, it's not casual for me to put my words in type. Then I have unlimited editorial control, and I'll never. Take me an hour to do something, I should just fire off. So
I'm the same way.
Totally get that. But I did. I was looking around on it, and I saw there was some pretty good press on you over time, but. Ironically, it was the easiest thing to find on you now is your donut shop and all the stuff you're doing now, and some really good journalism and a good couple interviews out there about your donut shop and the stuff you're doing.
That's good. That's what I want to hear.
And I want to talk about that, but I'm going to go a little bit out of order here, just because that's just what I want to do. But I'm curious before we even talk about donuts, why. I want to know more about how you transitioned out of music and why. I'm sure a lot of people ask you that already, but I'd like to discuss it, just a little bit. Like, do you have a concise, you may be getting tired of that one, but do you have a concise answer or anything you like to talk about on specifically why you wanted to move out of music?
Well, in my mind, it wasn't a conscious decision to move out of music. Uh-huh. I just had an idea for this donut shop and I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't working, like the music business has sort of consolidated and budgets have shrunk and, bands, want to make these huge records on tiny budgets and it just became harder and harder for me to make records, especially since I never built my own studio.
Mm-hmm.
So it became like almost impossible for me to make like records anymore. So I kind of needed to do something. And I was just at this fork in the road where I could either like build a studio or I've been talking about this donut shop for like years and years and years. And I don't know, I just kind of decided, I'm going to try this thing, you know, try this new thing that I've been talking about forever. So I never consciously said, I'm never going to make records again, or I'm leaving music. I just wanted to try something new for a little bit. I thought I would do it for a little bit, and then I'd grow it to a place where I could kind of venture off and do other things. And that was kind of the plan.
Well, that's interesting, that thing of what you say there that's interesting to me and I think a lot of people is how budgets have shrunk, and you have the choice of should you even build or buy a studio, which also is not really a good economic decision either. You know, studios are, it's a bad business overall. I mean, I know there's the top of the line ones will always be okay and everything, but you know, for a guy to build his own space, especially where you are in LA, to maintain and run that is a whole nother business on top of being a producer. And it's not like you live in the middle of somewhere cheap where you could build a big shed studio or something like that either. So it's a tough thing. And it's weird that something like that, from my point of view, it's not force out, because of course you could hang with it and do it and all that. But it's interesting that would put a squeeze on somebody that is a multi-platinum producer that's, you know, I'm not trying to overblow it here, but you are a really big deal as a producer, both to me and to tons of people in the whole music scene. And it's interesting that there could be some simple economic forces with labels and stuff like that that could make it hard to even compete or be comfortable for somebody at your level. I don't think people understand that about the music business. They think we're all rich.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, but definitely. And that's definitely not true. When I started making records, I was like, you know, it was like super scrappy and just making records in a few days or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just over the course of time, the time it took to make a record from like just a few days, it became, you know, where I needed to spend so much time on these things, and the budgets just were not, you know, just not, they didn't scale with the amount of time that we had to spend.
It's one of the worst things when there's the thing that makes you, not you specifically, but makes a producer something doing something like that, is the fact that you want to, the reason you got good at it and are good is because you want to spend as much time as you needed to get it the way that you heard it. And then when the budgets shrink and get smaller and smaller and smaller, now you're trying to cut corners on either time or sound or equipment or things like that. And it's very unpleasant. It's just not satisfying to have to think that way.
And expectations have changed too, you know, because the tools changed. You know, like when I started, it was all tape-based. And, you know, you didn't have the luxury of being able to really like dig in and edit drums or, you know, tune vocals and all that kind of stuff that just is a time suck.
Right.
And
so you were on tape until when? When did you switch out of tape?
I'm trying to think. I know that like Clarity actually was the first record I used Pro Tools on. But I was still recording to tape and then transferring into Pro Tools. And I did that for a while. I don't know exactly where I abandoned tape, but like there was a good chunk of time where I was like kind of doing both and A-B-ing and wanting to make the jump, but never feeling quite comfortable doing it. It might have been like, I think the first full Pro Tools record I did was probably like What It Is to Burn. From Finch.
Finch, yeah. That was 2002 or something like that.
Yeah, that might have been. I know that was the first one that I did completely in the box, mixed in everything. And that might have been the first one.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What are the other kind of stuff that you're talking about there with the tools changing that's a big deal? So you said that in a way that almost sounded. It was on this negative side a little bit, like, well, the tools changed and this and that happened. And so are you saying that those types of things made the business model different? Or are you talking about the sound? Because we were talking about the economics a little bit. So now how did that?
The only negative thing was just the expectations around, like the tools.
Yeah, that's right. That's what you were
saying. I love the tools. Like Pro Tools was a dream come true for me. Like to this day, still, like every time I get on Pro Tools, I'm reminded of my time in. I went to. It wasn't really a music school. but I studied computer music in college mm-hmm. or whatever, and we would have to like spend over, you know, like work all night on a mainframe computer, like computing, like reverb and shit. Yeah. And it was like crazy how slow and everything was. And I would just imagine like one day we're going to have a computer, like a whole recording studio in our computers or whatever, you know. And Pro Tools is that.
You could picture it coming the whole time and we're for it.
Yeah. And when it came, I was just so appreciative of it because it's so awesome mm-hmm. that what you can do now on a laptop or whatever.
I did music technology in college in the late 90s too. I did some stuff like that, and it was, you know, some just general MIDI stuff. And it was so technical just to have a terrible, you know, clarinet sound of something. It was unbelievable. And to see what it is really, really amazing. And then you could go home and record on your 4-track mixer. I wasn't doing any 2-inch tape because I wasn't in that world at the time. But I was just 4-track stuff. And then the very first digital recorders, but they were still like 4-track mixers, but that kind of thing. And general mm-hmm. MIDI to where it is today is very, very amazing. I similarly am reminded of like how amazing the stuff is. But the expectation change is a big deal because now I'm not putting words in your mouth, but you're saying now everybody expects these perfect drums and everything in time, and it changes the whole art form a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that less satisfying for you musically in that regard?
It really fed into my sort of perfectionist nature or whatever, mm-hmm. my tweaky, you know, I want everything to be perfect too. And so when I first got my hands on this technology or whatever, I embraced it fully and went, you know, full on into it and tweaked the crap out of everything.
Mega grid everything.
Yeah, yeah, at first. Like Clarity, you know, being the first one where I actually did that, I had to I had to redo it actually. I went through and edited all the drums and got really super tight and everything. And then I had to at one point I had to step back and go, whoa, this is like, this isn't good. I had to go mm-hmm. back and redo everything and kind of loosen everything up just because I just was using it like a sledgehammer or whatever. So, I mean, I don't remember what your question was.
Well, I'm just saying that even Clarity, I understand that part of it, but I remember hearing stuff getting better and better into where at some point I heard a record with everything perfect and replaced, and I said, what is this? What does this even sound like? It at some point you have that crossover moment where you go, this doesn't sound like anything a band is anymore.
Yeah.
But then it kept pushing through, and now it's just the expectations of modern recordings. And so now it's in this divergent place where modern recordings, a lot of them in that style, don't even sound like bands.
Yeah.
They, mm-hmm. they just don't. They don't even sound like what bands sound like. So you had this ability to say, oh, I can fix that kick drum to... We'll start by placing every kick drum exactly where we want it from the mm-hmm. get-go, and then we'll figure out who the band is or what they do and stuff. There's just a moment there for me. I remember thinking, this doesn't even sound like a band, and then later it's like, oh, this is what recordings sound like. So it kept on going, and the expectations kept on going. And mm-hmm. so it made it where people like you who had all these skills to handle the drummer, handle the band, get the best performances, it made some of those skills a little more obsolete, don't you think? That real skill of a producer to work with the musicians becomes a little bit less.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, you don't need, I mean, I feel like my skill was actually, I was pretty good at the whole tweaky part of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that I was actually better at that than I was at getting good performances, to be perfectly honest.
But even then you had these really good set of skills that now plugins literally can automatically do.
Yeah.
You know, you would tab and to transient and paste, I imagine, stuff like that. And now you just drop in the plugin and select the sample as they go. And you know. So it's, nonetheless, it takes a real, even mechanical skill that you had and it replaces it.
Yeah. Well, it there was still, even when you were like tabbing a transient and doing all that kind of stuff, there were still some judgment calls.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's definitely lost in plugins.
And so you didn't, with the decision to not ever go to a studio or to build something like that, do you feel like you started enjoying the, did you enjoy it less toward the later records you made versus, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s? I'm trying to put my finger on what point does...
Made was like one of them...
Go ahead, sorry. I had a glitch there on the Skype.
the last record I made was probably one of the most fun records I ever, mm-hmm. you know, was involved with. So I don't think it got any less fun. No.
Mm-hmm.
It just became harder to accept, to take on new projects. That's all, mm-hmm. really.
And so then, so the donut thing you'd had for, and your donut shop's called Donut Friend, and you'd had that idea for a long time?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I don't know how long before I actually made it happen. It was probably like 4 or 5 years or something I'd been talking about it.
That's real cool because so many, you know, everybody I know that's in one business or another, they have the pet idea. Everybody yeah. goes, well, one day I would do this, or I would have that. I want to open a taco truck. I'm going to do this or that or the mm-hmm. other thing. And then you did it. And it's got, I mean, it's a little bit inspiring. And in a sense, I bet some people are disappointed that you would do that instead of the other thing. But to me, it's pretty inspiring to leap into another territory when you have, you know, apparent mastery of the previous one, you know, because it's like all those hours, if you talked about the 10,000 hours or just mastery and real success, you've got platinum records and are known by, I mean, you're in the top, who, I mean, if you wanted to really think about the percentage of successful producers, how many people out of people that record music have done albums over decades and have platinum records and are that, is way less than one, you're in the way fractional of 1% of achieved producers. And that's not even based on like opinion. That's just, you know, mm-hmm. success speaking. And still to go into a whole go into a whole nother industry is a very brave thing. And to me, a really inspiring kind of thing.
I just, you know, it just sounded fun. It sounded yeah. exciting and new and you know, not that, you know, I don't feel like I ever nailed making records or whatever, mm-hmm. or feel like I, you know, knew everything, because I definitely didn't, and there's always new stuff to learn.
Sure.
But, you know, it was the idea of just picking up something I knew nothing about, which was baking and
you
bread.
Were a just a donut fan, at least? You at least love donuts, I would imagine.
I mean, everybody does, you know.
Yeah, I think you're
but,
right.
No, I mean, I wasn't like, I was just saying the other night, like, actually, I really love ice cream. Like uh-huh. if I was going to have a passion about something, it'd mm-hmm. be ice cream, not donuts, you know? But I mean, I love donuts. It was just the idea uh-huh. That I had that it was something that I didn't want to see anybody else do. And the thought of me having this idea and someone else coming along later on and doing it would have, you know, killed me or whatever. So I needed to make it happen.
So it's inspired. And what would you call the, heck, genre is not the right word, but what is the market or type of donuts? I want to say it's boutique, or it's in the vein of Top Pot in Seattle, or Voodoo in Portland, or Mighty O, something, stuff like that. Like, what do you call that? Not Krispy Kreme or Dunkin' Donuts. It's different than that.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, we're definitely, you know, we use better ingredients and we do mm-hmm. everything from scratch. So we're not like a typical corner donut shop. But I never think of us like, you know, like fancy gourmet donuts.
Right. Well, I mean, there's something, I'm not trying to force, you know, an analogy here, but it's like, it's artisan. It's more like, or it's independent, or it's almost like an indie donut. I mean, it's a yeah. boutique. There's something about it that's more like, you know, I don't know better parallels to make, but it's like a boutique amp shop versus Marshall.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you do special things local, like the names of the donuts are very niche. They're hilarious, by the way. I'll tell you a couple of the donuts if people don't know what they do, but they're all, a lot of them are music inspired names, or maybe all of them are, but and bands you've worked with, and especially there's Bacon 182, Cinna Mineral is my favorite one of their Custard Front Drive, Jets to Basil, and the best one of all to me is Fritter Seems Forever. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
A hilarious name. But it's you know, it's still something about this that you can tell that you put the care and time into the making of the donuts and the ingredients and stuff like that. How do you find, or what part of it is discovery and testing ingredients and stuff like that versus just ordering shit out of a catalog?
That the whole testing and discovery part happened early on.
Uh-huh.
Actually, we're still doing it. You know, we're still trying to introduce new things.
New donut, yeah.
New donut or new things. Like, we just, we're going to start doing more and more ice cream type things or whatever. So I'm getting gearing up to start doing some recipe testing with ice cream and stuff. So it's still happening. And that's the part I really love. I love the sort of nerdy process of, like, you know, methodically going through ingredients and mm-hmm. recipes and changing little things and testing and tweaking and all that kind of stuff. That's fun to me.
What is the cinnamon roll donut? What is that one?
It's a really, like, a classic, like, cinnamon crumb donut, you know? A lot of our donuts are, like, things that, you know, you'd find anywhere, but mm-hmm. we just call it.
Mine's favorite is real simple, but my favorite donut is a fluffy kind that's covered with cinnamon and sugar. Just a ring, cinnamon sugar ring. That's my favorite donut. What is that? What's the difference in that and the crumble one you're saying? And I've got a glitch here. Can you hear me?
Oh, now I do. Okay. Yeah.
Did you hear what I said?
You started talking about your favorite donut.
I said my favorite donut is a cinnamon ring, just cinnamon sugar on a fluffy donut.
Uh-huh.
That's not okay. The same thing you're saying with the crumble, cinnamon crumble. Is that like a old-fashioned donut?
It's close. It's like just a regular cake donut, vanilla cake donut with vanilla glaze. And then we take our, like, day-old cake and chocolate cake donuts mm-hmm. and we sort of bake it with cinnamon and sugar added in there. And then it just sort of makes this, like, crumble topping or whatever, and we put that on top.
Oh, that sounds so good. And where are you, in Highland Park in LA? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a neighborhood of Los Angeles.
Is it close to downtown? How can I find that next time I'm there? I was just there. I wish I would have thought about it.
Oh, man, you should have come by. It's like 20 minutes north of downtown.
20 minutes north of downtown?
Yeah, 15.
So is it an easy stop when we're coming, you know, over the grapevine on our way to Hollywood next time?
Yeah, it's not that far out of the way. Like, if you're cruising down the 5, it's a quick jaunt mm-hmm. down, you know, north a little bit. But yeah, it's easy.
Well, we'll make sure to do it. The how is the business of donuts? Is it a lot more viable than the music? Like, as far as it's not as a dying or shrinking kind of thing. Does it feel like it's a good thing going forward, going up, stable?
Well, I wouldn't say it's stable. Because I feel like right now donuts are having a moment or mm-hmm. whatever. So I feel like it's gonna pass. We're doing pretty well right now. But
donut bubble of 2016.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's the fad, whatever. You know, it's like emo of its day or whatever. You know, like it's donuts. And so I don't know how it's gonna last. I don't know how long it's gonna last. I don't know what it's gonna be like when the bubble pops. You know. Mm-hmm. But right now it's been great.
That's good. And everything is vegan. That's the last technical question I have about donuts. But it's all vegan?
Yeah.
And so what is the main ingredient you have to avoid to make it vegan?
Milk and eggs.
Oh, I see. Eggs is probably in a lot of the batters otherwise.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Flour. Okay, so what do you use for egg substitute that works the same way?
Well, we use like a, you know, this like Bob's Red Mill egg replacer or whatever. And it just helps. And like really, you know, when you think about it, bread, mm-hmm. French bread is flour, water, yeast, you know, sugar, a little bit, maybe some salt, whatever. It's like 5 ingredients, whatever. Mm-hmm. Vegan.
Right.
And no one would be like, you know, French bread's vegan. You know?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. Isn't
doesn't
it?
Have,
yeah.
Bread doesn't have to be, you don't have to use dairy in bread for it to be awesome. So,
and
you know.
It's fried in oil, which is
it's
not.
It's fried in oil, yeah.
So. What oil do you fry in?
A soy.
Soy.
Actually, it's that's the hard thing for us to avoid is soy. Because we have like soy stuff in everything. We use like a little bit of soy milk instead of milk, you know.
Oh,
we use there's soy in our like in the egg replacer. It's like everywhere. We fry in soy.
Interesting. That's all really cool stuff. So and you had the shop going how long now?
Two and a half years.
And you put in time, what do you do like daily there? What's your day look like at the shop?
Well, now I've got people where I used to be the baker. I would make all the donuts and mm-hmm. everything. Now I have bakers that do that for me. Now I'm just sort of like, you know, I'm trying to work on a second location. So I spend a lot of time working on that, doing that kind of stuff.
So you enjoy the business development part of it too, as well as the donuts.
I never wanted to own a donut shop. Uh-huh. Like what I wanted to do was build a brand and like kind of grow something But like the actual day to day of a donut shop is not, that's not what I wanted.
Sure.
So yeah, I'm kind of having more fun focusing on the stuff that's not like donut shop.
And so if you're totally successful and continue to have more and more success here, will it be continue up in this industry, or do you think you know, might have a whole nother pet, a whole nother career in a whole nother place down the road?
This will probably be it, I think. I don't know. I think you
that's
get one.
That's cool to hear.
Yeah, we'll see where it takes me, you know. And I've been playing shows again, so like music is still has come back. So
good,
I'm
good.
Playing drums and having a lot of fun doing that. And I was actually talking to some bands about doing records again.
Oh, excellent. So. I'm glad to hear that. I'm sure everybody would be glad to hear that. And so I told you I'd go a little bit out of order here, and you brought up Clarity and that stuff a minute ago, and I moved right past it. But don't worry. That's because I wanted to come back to it and have time to talk about it while we were still doing that. So everybody, don't worry. We're going to talk about some bands and some recordings and some music now. Now, the band in there that is huge to me, so... our band Emery is hugely influenced by several records that you did. One of them being Mineral, the In Serenading. That record is one of the very first things I ever heard that was independent or indie or not. Like I grew up in a small town and we didn't know there's anything other than Kid Rock and Korn and Deftones. It was like the weirdest thing I knew of, and just because it made it onto TV or radio. I didn't even know this indie music existed until I was in college and had a buddy that played for us. You know. Clarity and Mineral and stuff like that. So that is a tremendous. You did just that one Mineral record. I mean, I guess they didn't really even do it much more after that. But do you recall that recording and doing that? Do you recall that time very much?
Yeah. My memory is pretty spotty, but I do remember making the Mineral record. Yeah.
Yeah, when you mentioned the tools, I think that's an interesting part. I'm going to try and play a couple of clips, and we'll see if it comes over Skype and how this works.
Okay.
But I'm going to try and hopefully if the level's too loud or something or quiet, let me know. I'm going to play a couple of clips to give reference to the listener, and we can discuss some of the stuff there. But in the you mentioned the tools changing and stuff like this, and I don't remember what this would have been, 90. It would have been late 90s still, Mineral. So I imagine that was not in the computer or anything like that.
Yeah, I think this was all tape. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so I'm going to try and play just a clip so people can hear what is the first track on In Serenading. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What does that bring back for you? Anything?
I actually it put me back into the studio.
Really?
Like sitting in the control room listening to that. Yeah.
The clearly it's just such a loose, raw thing, and obviously the stick out thing, and not that you can't tell just from one clip. If you listen to that music in that time, I think it's so cool and so powerful, but yet so out of tune vocally.
Oh yeah.
How did that transition from that time to a couple of records later and everything could be just perfectly in tune? Is that just a matter of the tools, or is that a matter of that band or that style to you?
Well, probably both. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the vocals on the Mineral record were very, I wouldn't say improvised, but kind of like. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was more like poetry that was just kind of melodically sung or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was more about, the words and the emotions or whatever, and less about tuning.
But when you were producing that at that time as a tweaky person, like you described, what were you trying to get, like, were you aware of it with your ear and thought this is cool, or did you wish that you could get it better? Would you have tuned it if you could?
I think if I had the tools at that time, there would have definitely been an impulse to mm-hmm. to try and tune them, and I would have gotten a lot of pushback from the band.
They wouldn't have wanted it.
They wouldn't have wanted
That's
it.
Super
yeah,
cool.
I mean, at the time, it was great. You know, I didn't have that impulse as much because I mean, I could recognize that they're out of tune, obviously, but like, you know, it wasn't an option to do anything about it. We just had to keep just, it was either recorded again or, you know, like, oh yeah, it's you know.
So without the tools, when you're doing the tape and the earlier recordings and stuff like that, what are you focusing on? What can you tweak? What were you concerned with at the time? Like, what was in your head that you were really trying to nail then that you thought you were really getting somewhere with?
For me, back then, I was looking for the sort of like, it's kind of the opposite, I guess, of now, maybe. I don't know. Like, now maybe you're focusing, trying to get things more in tune, and you're looking for perfect performances, closer to perfection and whatever. Mm-hmm. Back then, I was actually focused on the fuck-ups and the mistakes and, like, you know, like, the cool things that you couldn't really replicate,
yeah.
You know, the accidents, you know, those kinds of things. And if we got a lot of those cool, like, moments, that was an awesome take kind of thing.
I'm going to give another mineral clip while we're here.
Mm-hmm.
This one's full with all the band and drums and everything. I really am thankful for the lack of tool. I mean, I really appreciate how it turned out. It was really formative for me and for us and the things that I've done. And yet, nonetheless, my impulse is fix everything still. Even though this was the first stuff that I was blown away by, my impulse still is, well, we got to fix it. I got to clean it up. Well, we got to sing that again, and I'm going to tune it, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah. It's really seductive.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, it's easy to be drawn into that. And if not having the ability, I mean, I think that's when it, I don't know if you've ever gotten into these heated arguments about tape versus Pro Tools or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I've always maintained that, like, it's not about the technical differences between the two, like the sonic differences between the two things. I've always thought it was the lack of options.
It's the process.
Tape.
Yeah.
Yeah. That made the difference. It had nothing to do with tape itself, other than it was so much harder to go. You could still do all those things. Like when I first started recording and going, like, you know, I started in a small studio, but at some point I started going to bigger studios, and I would see how, like, these massive records were made. And even with tape, people back then, and I never was able to do this, so I didn't have the budgets back then even to do this, but, like, people were still editing drums on tape.
Yeah, cutting them with a razor blade.
Yeah, or still tuning vocals, you know, by, you know, like, playing vocals into a sampler and speeding them and slowing them down or whatever. But it took so long, and you have, like, I remember walking into Sound City for the first time and seeing the assistant engineer sitting there with a measuring tape that represented, like, the space between a, you know, like a kick and a snare was supposed to be or whatever, and they would measure it, and then if it was off by a little bit, they would, you know, splice the tape.
Yeah, and it's math and BPM and charts, like delay charts and everything,
crazy.
So you know what the quarter note, how many milliseconds or inches of tape, you know.
Exactly, yeah. It was insane. So, like, but, you know, like, when I was making Mineral, I couldn't do that. And I think that's why it was what it was, you know?
Yeah.
Super raw.
And I don't know if you're that way sonically entirely, but I feel the same way. But I thought it was interesting, even on Donut Friends Frequently Asked Questions, it says there, what is your donuts made from? How does this work? What is this, you know, what are your hours? And then the last one says, how did you get that guitar sound on Clarity?
Oh, yeah.
And then you say it's a, I don't remember what it is, 57 and a 421 through 1073, whatever. Some technical answer like that. And I'm curious how you meant that. Is that like, yeah, it's just this technical thing, who cares? Or it's like, are you really into that part of recording?
No, I'm not. I'm not into, like, the technical part of it, mm-hmm. really. Like, I collected some gear, you know, I liked having things that I was comfortable with or whatever, but, like, I was never super nerdy when it came mm-hmm. to, like, you know, having the best gear or, like, you know, like, I don't know. Like, I'd always just walk into a studio and the equipment that was there usually was what I ended up using, and you just did the best I could with what I had.
But you don't, like, for instance, I didn't read from that is what you do to make guitars awesome.
I mean, that was usually my go-to thing, you know, the two mics and a 1073 or in some sort of mic pre or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I always used a 57 and a 421.
Yeah.
that was, I wouldn't say that's how I it makes things awesome. That's just what I did.
Yeah. But yeah, that's interesting. But you're still more about the process than the specific sonics of the.
I'm more about, like, when it comes to guitar sounds, really the answer should be, how do you get that guitar? You start with a great amp. That's the real answer. It's like, it doesn't matter what mic you use. I mean, it does, I guess, but you know, if you've got a great amp and a great player,
of course, yeah,
you know, then the sonics take care of themselves.
The first time I was in the studio, the producer told me, or I'm saying, tone this. He said, well, tone comes from your hands.
Yeah.
I was like, I was so frustrated that they said that, because I'm trying to work with the treble and gain here. Can you please help me? And you know, and that's what his response was. And he's definitely right. It took me a long time to even think that way and shift that way, but certainly it's true.
Oh yeah. The same player on the same equipment, or two different players on the same equipment, such a different sound.
Yeah, I had another moment like that. We were doing a show with From Autumn to Ashes one time, and somewhere in New York, something. And I walked in the room and I thought, this is the best guitar sound I've ever heard. And I was like, that guy Brian is so good. And I was like, hey, I need to go see your amp and show me what you do. I've got to check this out. And he had a Les Paul plugged into a Mesa, and every knob was exactly straight up. And there was nothing else there. I was like, oh. I was like, okay. And I never forgot that. I don't think I stopped caring about gear shortly after, almost in response to that, how much I realized that it was just what he does, just the way he plays the chords. I don't know. It just definitely comes from his hands for sure.
Everybody wants the easy button, you know, since they could just push that button and it's going to sound rad or whatever. But you're right. It's the hands. It's the person.
Okay, so then you go from Mineral, and then shortly after that, you are on Pro Tools and you're doing Clarity. And Clarity is, I don't know. I mean, it might be one of the most important. I don't know how to say what came after it, because I know people have been influenced by it from every kind of genre. But at least for defining, you know, to me, what emo was and is like that Mineral and Sunday Real Estate, and then Jimmy Eat World Clarity was pretty much this peak, this kind of thing. And then maybe it was a kickoff point for other people, but to me it's like a jewel in the crown of what the epitome of what people were trying to do and stuff at the time. And I admit fully that could just be it's not just me. I was gonna say it could just be my opinion or my time when I entered that world and discovered music in that way or started being creative. I don't think it's that. I do think that actually is a landmark record. And I won't make you agree with me if you don't want to, but I really do feel that way. And I'm sure objectively that's true in some sense. I know, you know, it's interesting because that one does have a lot of really clean or perfect stuff on it. Like with one of the most legendary things that come out of that is the drum loop on Lucky Denver Mint. Mm-hmm. So, and I'll play that. And so, The song starts that way, and then at the end it fades out with that. So it must be important enough, and you must have known that this is something special enough to start the song and then have another minute at the end of the track with this on a catchy song. But let's just talk about this drum loop.
Okay.
What can you tell me about it?
It was... it's still going?
Yeah. You can ignore it. I'll fade it out.
It was... the drum loop came... Like, Jim did the demo, and that was in the demo. His drum loop. He came up with that. I played with it at the end. So at the end was like me messing around with it or whatever.
Yeah.
Just trying to figure out how to.
The actual sound from his demo was imported into the song, or are you just saying the part was written? The beat existed.
Yeah. That whole loop. We redid the loop or whatever for the record, but yeah, it's like that idea was the thread that went through the whole song through the demo.
And so even at the very beginning of that, is that edited sequencing, or is that just a processing of room mics and whatever of Zach playing?
It is. How did I record that? I think that was like a whole separate setup. I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a mic, a single mic or something, or maybe a stereo mic or something. I'm not sure. I actually don't remember.
Well, and then the stuff you did at the end is still really important because it represents this new time in recording when these things were possible. You know, like you were using computers and you could do stuff. And it inspired a generation of I'm telling you, it inspired a generation of people that thought it would be cool to have this garage rock band go to the next level where you could have loops or programming and samplers. So there's a lot of technology that was coming along the way, but how to use it, this being very important, I mean, is one of the earlier things there. And you hear that fingerprint just all over the place. So I think that's one of the really, I've got a few things here just from this record that I hear constantly in bands 10 and 15 years later that I'm going, oh yeah. And we all know this is just our shared background and this is where we got these ideas. You know, I hear, and I'm not meaning that bad way. We copy it. I could tell you a bunch. I'm not saying other bands are bad that did take these ideas. I think it's great and it's part of like our shared heritage. But another one is the, and I want to know where you got this from or how you got this experience. It may have existed before, but the thing where you do muted guitar string rakes with the snare drum. So I'll play I'll play that, but like going into this chorus here out of the bridge, for instance.
Oh yeah.
So that is just like incredibly common and done, and I feel like most people in the worlds that I go in, that's where they got it from, exactly that. Does that even stick out in your mind as a thing or ever thought about that?
No, and I know that I got it from someone else. I mean, that was just something that...
Do you think it was you, though, versus the band? That's another good question.
I think that... I mean, that, like...
Yeah,
that
with
kind
the
of thing is just a...
It's, at the same
it's
time.
Almost a cliche in a way, you know, like... it's just a cliche kind of, like, thing that rock bands do, you know?
I'm not aware of it in earlier than 2000 being common is what I'm saying. And
really?
I'm sure you heard it somewhere or whatever, but that instance of it happens in that song more than once is, I think, the shared reference for most people that do it now. I think that's one of the largest examples of it. It's really aggressive, you know. It takes out the tonality and everybody gets together and it represents that era where you can get stuff tight, you know. It's just an expression of tightness or something like that. But I think that's a really powerful one. But you don't even recall that or think much about it?
I don't think we thought too much about it. I think if we thought anything about it, it was like that it might be kind of cheesy or something, you know, like we're worried about maybe just being kind of doing something bad.
If that's the case, can you imagine how cheesy and criticizable and cliche it is of those of us who are doing it 15 years later? That's funny. So you don't think that, you don't recognize what I am recognizing as like important moments as you know, they don't even stand out to you in that way. I think that's interesting. I think they're super. I mean, is there anything about the Clarity record that you think was important from your point of view?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not hearing it the same way. Like when I
certainly not. Yeah.
Like, it's interesting to hear you point out certain things like that. Like that. That's interesting for me to even think that might be a moment.
But I mean, you understand that it's an important record, and people think that, and so now we have to do a little bit of the work of what is it? So I know we would have completely different points of view on it, but that's what the point of this podcast is. From your point of view, knowing that Clarity is important, I want you to tell me why, from your point of view.
Like right now?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just curious. Like, is there something on it that you think is amazing or awesome? Or and maybe I'm just wrong or these are just my things, but I think Clarity is an important record. It's almost objectively true. Mark Trombino, what is important about Clarity? Whether technical or not. Technical would be cool, but I mean, in any sense, why do you think that record is special?
I don't mean to evade the question or whatever, but I do not have an answer for you. Like, to me, it was a record I made back at that time. You know, for me personally, I can tell you why personally it was special for me. And that was because of the transition technology-wise. It was the first Pro Tools record the first record I used Pro Tools on. So for me personally, I was seeing kind of what I could do with this stuff, you know, and so experimenting with loops and cutting things up and, you know, I was able to bring more of myself into the record, which I hadn't been able to do before. Like, you know, when I was doing Mineral, I'm, you know, just coaching and guiding or whatever, but like there's not my thumb. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it is. My thumb fits on there, but like this one, I was actually actively participating in the record.
Well, see, that's not an evasive answer whatsoever. That's a tremendous answer, and it's similar to what I'm saying in a different way. But the fact that you could take a band like that, a real raw indie band, and then also add these new elements of programming, technology, and timing, and clean. That really did kick off a new era. I mean, I know it was based on the technology, but also the technology gave you, a talented person like you, the ability to directly contribute creatively with the band. And I think that's a really big deal. I think that record made by somebody else is not the same thing. I really also like I've also got a couple other things in there that stand out to me that maybe are less of a big deal to everybody else, but the emptiness kind of in here and the clean guitar on this first track. First of all, the first track being this one, I'm sure that's a band decision, but a not heavy or not aggressive track, an empty, pretty, almost fruity track is really a great decision in my opinion. Yeah. And the emptiness of it and this really sparkly clean, I'd love to ask you if you remember anything about recording that clean guitar, but that's kind of a big deal to me. And then the last thing will be the extra loud, prominent harmonies, but we'll get back to that one.
Okay. But
what do you think about that that type of clean guitar there?
I don't remember recording the guitar.
Yes, that's nice.
I do remember early on we were thinking this was going to be the first song. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of that is in effect now. I don't know how much song order matters anymore. I'm not sure. But like back then, because we were thinking about everything being on an LP,
yep,
you know, there was like ways to divide the record that we thought about constantly through the process. And so this was the opening song. We knew what song was going to end the first side, start the second side, mm-hmm. end the second side. You know, like we had that already kind of mapped out really early on. I don't remember that clean guitar part.
And it's brave that just to do it that way, which is inspiring. But the harmony thing is in this genre and this style and at that time and on that recording and on that song, the harmonies became louder and louder. And Jimmy Eat World's another band that had a really early band that had two prominent vocalists. And so it feels to me like, and I'm interjecting there, I'm projecting is what I'm doing, that it is that born out of the fact that you have two guys that are good singers, that why not just have extra singing? So instead of thinking of this really backgroundy harmony, you think sometimes two singers. Was that, is a strength or a co, it's not a co-lead singer, even though he, what's the second singer's name?
It's Tom.
Tom, like, so he sang on some records lead vocals instead of Jim.
Yeah.
So when you have two guys like that, does that make is that part of the birth of these, I'm identifying as harmonies being a lot louder and prominent as parts in the arrangements at this point in music?
I'm not sure, because so much of the harmonies is just Jim doing it himself.
True. But nonetheless, it's still really prominent harmonies, you'd agree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Like that's not tucked away like mainstream music's harmonies kind of thing. It's like, oh, I hear this other really dry, clear voice doing this other thing that's a part. It's an arrangement.
I don't know because I don't know why, but like when I'm singing along to records, it's 9 times out of 10 the harmony part that I'm singing along to. So maybe that's just I like harmonies or something, and maybe I mix them louder because that's kind of what I like or something. It just could be a weird tweak in my brain.
Oh, I'm sure it's your preference, but I'm sure you weren't calculated in doing it in that way. But I'm just identifying that I think that sets the stage for, gets the ball rolling on a pivotal record like this. I think that largely contributes to bands that with two lead singers and extra vocal parts and really aggressive vocals, and you know, from Brand New, Take Back Sunday, you know, these successors, and certainly Emery and a bunch of other bands that are saying more of that. Mm-hmm. I think it sets the stage for bands to go, okay, two singers, more singers, louder harmonies, more arranged harmonies that are different, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's an expression I think that also came out of that record. You didn't invent harmonies or it's not like, you know, yeah. mixing them louder is a taste choice in that case, but an important one is what I'm pointing at. Uh-huh. And just curious what your take was or thought on it.
Other than what I said.
It's just the way you hear it. Do you always do you think you always are a loud harmony guy? Is that you think that's just across the board when you're mixing?
I mean, honestly, I never thought that they were loud until you're saying it.
prominent. I don't know. Maybe not prominent. Loud. I'm not saying it's a mixing error. It's a prominent, though. Featured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I just thought that's just, yeah, I never actually thought about it, which is, it's weird. I should have thought about it, but yeah.
I don't mean to be making you uncomfortable. I'm just curious, you know, just looking for your take on some of those things. I was listening to this second track on here that's people. Oops, let's see. I was listening to the second track on here, which I don't even remember the title of, but such a cool one. This one is an often copied kind of thing. I'm not sure if all our listeners are even familiar with it, so I'm just giving a little bit more background on this work. But this aggressive palm muting and drums and noisy stuff, this really sounds like an Under Oath song, a specific one, to tell you the truth. But again, not accusing them of copying or anything, but this style is just so pervasive in the decade that follows. And I think this song's influence. I can hear this in a bunch of songs. Loud, don't you think those harmonies are prominent? You at least agree, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Yeah, and it's almost feels trade-off-y vocals, prominent. I don't know. Really interesting.
That was definitely a trade-off because like that was Tom in there going back and forth.
Yeah, so I think that was a super big one. And I think those are the things about it. But to me, I trace emo from that way, Mineral to Jimmy Eat World. And then it just keeps on going. It's like and then eventually you did the Motion City record.
I mixed that one,
another one that's just, I mean, it's weird because I think, do you think the bands that, do you notice this effect when you had success that the bands that you would wind up recording were bands that were just big fans of the other stuff, therefore, you know, there's a little bit of a feedback loop of Motion City soundtrack starting a song this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's a really a lot like, you know, it's one of their biggest songs, and it harkens back to Lucky Denver Mint in that sense that it starts with the loop kind of thing like that. Is that, but that's why they probably wanted to have Mark Trombino mix it and say, mix it like that clarity. You know, is it like, do you find that feedback loop to be a good thing or a bad thing? Like people want you to just keep doing the same stuff that you've done.
I mean, it's both, naturally. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's great that people want you to, you know, they want to work with you. Mm-hmm. That's good. But yeah, you're right. It is like people wanting to recreate the same things over and over. Like, you know, it became, everybody wanted clarity, you know?
Is that it, though? That's what they're always wanting when they come?
Clarity was the one, yeah. Okay. Definitely. Out of all the records I'd made, Clarity is the one that people are like, we want that.
Like, like we're working on, you have an idea, and they're thinking, Mark, could we make it a little more like Clarity? Well, what did we do? What did you do on Clarity? Maybe we could do that here.
Yeah, I would definitely get some of that.
And so you wanted to push away from that or do things different?
Yeah, I want to keep evolving and keep growing and doing new things, and you know, being constantly kind of like, you know, no, could we do, you know, do this old thing? Like, always kind of bothered me.
Did as the genre of emo and these bands keep getting, they feel younger and younger, and I think emo ends sometime around that, and then it becomes Dashboard, and then it's this, and eventually it's like bands like All Time Low that you did a record of theirs, and that's like, is that an emo band? And to me, no, it just isn't. But I'm curious, do you have a definitions of that genre, or how do you find the work that's derivative from it or trace that progression? Do you think that's the same?
I agree with you. I feel like even calling Jimmy World an emo band is kind of a stretch. To me, emo starts with, like, I think of Rites of Spring.
Yeah.
And
mid-90s is where it is for you.
Where it's like super aggressive music, not melodic, pretty, you know,
pop.
You know, poppy stuff, but like aggressive music with like super, you know, emotional lyrics or whatever, like talking about, you know, like not talking about politics or like, you know, like super big important issues, but talking about personal issues and stuff. And that's what I think of as emo. So like when I always like was like, Jimmy World emo? I don't think so. Or all these bands, but.
Well, it's just, it just depends on where you, I mean, I don't like that either, but it seems to be subjective to just, I mean, the word, the name of the definition of the word certainly changes. Just like any word.
Changed.
I mean, if a million people start calling it one thing, then that's what, that is what the word then becomes.
Yeah.
And you have to, it's hard, it's frustrating because you don't want to go back and redefine what was to keep it separate. I mean, you have that problems in political movement or part, you know, we have that problem right now in politics. It's mm-hmm. what is conservative, what is Democrat? Well, it means what exactly what it is right now. You could say yeah. what it used to mean, but it, this is the state of conservative politics. This is it.
Yeah.
This is what right. the right wing is or what, you know. So mm-hmm. it's kind of interesting to see those things go. But do you mourn that or like are you fully embrace All Time Low and the new bands? Like when you have to keep working with stuff that's, yeah, how do you take that? I don't know a good way to phrase that.
I'm not sure. The progression of music. I love it. Like mm-hmm. All Time Low is amazing. Like, are they emo? I don't
yeah.
think so personally. I will say it tongue in cheek or whatever. Take it whatever for what it is. But musically, it's awesome. I love music that continues to grow and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
I never got tired of working with. Like I liked working with newer bands because they were. Doing new things and pushing the envelope or whatever. Yep. I didn't want to keep working, making the same record. Yep. So evolutionarily or whatever, like super down.
Well,
for
certainly
all
nothing wrong with that band or anything like that. And I don't mean it that way, but what bands and what kind of music have people asked you and wanted you to do through the course of your career that you just didn't want to do? Like, would you do a record for good money that you didn't like the music or what was that? What were some of that types of music or decisions you had to make?
I mean, I've definitely turned down things that I didn't want to do.
Just based on you didn't like the music.
Yeah, I felt...
Or could you have fun making, you know, getting paid good to do your skill on something that you didn't artistically enjoy?
Just my personality doesn't work in situations like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not the kind of guy that... I'm not great around people, like, mm-hmm. let's be honest. And, like, I am not... I can't walk into a room and just be like, just have fun making a record if I don't like the music and yep. I don't like what I'm doing. And people will know it, that I'm not into it and I don't like what they're doing and it's not a good environment
mm-hmm.
in a studio, you know? So I've early on I learned I have to really be into whatever mm-hmm. I'm doing because I can't bullshit it. I can't fake yep. it or whatever. So I've made a conscious decision just to only do things. There was a couple records I took on where I wasn't into it and I learned that like it's bad that I have to actually love what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wouldn't say surprised, but interested to hear how much you are not, if you just looked at it on paper, you might expect to encounter a jaded, ex-producer here. And I don't find you that way at all, which is really nice. Like
no.
you seem very I don't even know what the word is for it, but I think that's interesting that you know you identify things the way that you do, but you
not
don't seem like yeah. Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, no, sorry
yeah.
about that. Not too bad, just a couple of glitches so far. But the I find it nice that you're not just a jaded person that's anti this and oh I quit doing it because the kids and then the music and then the money and all that stuff.
No, not at all. I like new music.
Good.
I've always liked new music. And I would, it's like music that's being made. I've always get in this argument with people who are like, you know, music today, it's not like it used to be.
Right.
And I'm like, bullshit. Like music today is better than it ever
awesome.
Has been. The tools have made like I feel like the fact that, you know, people can make records in their bedrooms now, like, you know, as a producer, it's sort of put me out of business. But it means that we're making... like better records than ever, in my mm-hmm. opinion. Like because like it's more intimate. It's like the artists are making the records now. Mm-hmm. There's less people involved. You know, a lot of times, and it seems more direct and it's more like pure.
I think so too. And also, we've hit that threshold where now that everything can be programmed and perfect, we are in this very very exciting stage to me where we can push back into raw and it will actually feel like progression forward. Like
yeah.
you hear more intimate, all the living room shows and the acoustic intimate performances captured on one mic. That actually is now looking as favorable and really showing talent again versus mm-hmm. you know, it's like a way to
seems fresh
to show real talent in a way that it, before the signal was, well, if you have more backing musicians and better production and more of this, it shows your talent. And it reached an extreme to where it was overdone or could be bought or paid for or be done by less talented people. So now if we're back to, you know, trying to really demonstrate what people have to say, it's a pretty nice thing. So we've just saturated in a way the technology stuff, but also there's a bunch of new technology coming that's probably going to empower a bunch of more people to come up with some whole new stuff. So yeah, you're optimistic even about the future of music and technology.
I think
one more glitch here. Sorry. Right. Say that again. If you, say that one more time. Yeah.
I am optimistic, mm-hmm. optimistic about the future because, I don't think it's, up to this point, it's gotten worse. I think it's only gotten better. So why wouldn't it continue?
That's great. Are you that way across the board? Are you that way with culture and society, everything?
Less so much with society, but I do recognize that we as a people have always thought things are getting worse. It's mm-hmm. just human nature to think mm-hmm. things are not as good as they were in the past. So I do feel like, you know, I relate to that certainly when I look around, but at the same time, I recognize that it's just humans, just being humans, and things definitely aren't any worse than they used to be. They're just, we just think they are.
Yeah. So that's really good. So last thing I want to ask you is, when you think about your legacy, is that something you're interested in?
Yeah.
Would you prefer to be known for the work that you did? I'll put it this way. Would you trade the ability to do anything you want for the rest of your life and succeed at it and be fulfilled by it, but in exchange, after you're gone, your name is not remembered with those things that you have previously and in the future will do, achieve, create?
Versus what? Like
versus just keep on struggling through life the way it is now and build, you know, your Wikipedia page says all the stuff you've done. Your donut shop was Mark Trombino's donut shop. This is his whatever, his legacy. I'm saying for the rest of your life, you could have full success. You will, everything you try to do, you'll be able to achieve. But when you die, your name, those things will still exist, but your name is erased from them.
I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but I
always
do
try to ask it. I've never asked it exactly right yet still, but I'm interested. I feel like I would say, I don't care what people say about me when I'm gone. I just care about while I'm here. I want to experience the things. I want to create stuff. I want to make stuff. I want to do stuff, and I want to do it well and have that go well. I want to have resources and, you know, and be able to achieve what I want to achieve. I'd like to be more successful in this and that, but when I'm gone, I don't care if you take my name off of it. I would trade that.
I agree with that. Like, I just want to be happy.
They're both ego questions. Like, one is, I want to be known forever because even when I'm gone, I want people saying the name of Mark Trombino. Mm-hmm. And the other one is saying, I want what I want now for me. Those are really the only two choices.
Yeah, the second one is the way I go. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, when I'm gone, doesn't matter to me.
Right.
I don't care. So yeah, I'd rather be happy now, and I want to feel like, you know, fulfilled and feel like I have a purpose
yep.
doing what I'm doing, and that's pretty much it.
I like that answer. Most people don't go that way with it, but I that's the way I tend to think. It sounds, yeah. I mean, if your name disappears off the internet when you're dead, so what? I'm dead. That's the way I look at it. I'm not here.
Exactly.
You know, of course, I want my wife and daughter to think I'm cool and remember me, but beyond that, I don't care.
Really. Yeah.
I'm trying to just enjoy this life and do stuff and make stuff.
Yeah.
And if I make it and it's good for people in society, good. I still don't even care if I get the credit. The only reason I care about my name attached now is because it helps me to continue next time or get the next record or do the next show.
Right.
Or whatever kind of thing. So anyway, I just was curious. I'm interested in what people think about their legacy. People that are successful and doing stuff. But, you know, I think it's an interesting area, but I'm not particularly adept at asking getting there yet, but I'm working on that question. I'll get it down. I'm gonna keep asking people until I can phrase it.
I definitely worry about my legacy. That is definitely something I do worry about, like, because I mean, another reason why I'm reluctant to make records anymore, it's just like I do worry that I don't have that I worry that I don't have what I used to have as far as creative input or whatever into these things. And like, I don't want to make bad records, you
know? Yeah. That's another good way to phrase it would be, would you eliminate the idea of having a legacy just to make certain that you could avoid not having a bad, like a tarnished legacy would be worse than the opportunity to have a good one. Like, yeah, you don't care if you have a huge legacy and people say your name forever, except for if it was in a tarnished way, then you would care.
Yeah.
Right. That's an interesting caveat too.
which is equally silly to worry about both.
Yeah, yeah. I guess so. Yeah, I guess that's right. I guess I didn't think about it until you just said that. But yeah, I definitely don't want a bad legacy as some asshole or loser or guy who thought he was something or did some harm. That would be, that'd be worse for sure.
Yeah.
I'd rather have none.
But it shouldn't be, right? Like, it shouldn't be any worse.
Yeah, for the same reason I say I don't care if it's good. Yeah, maybe that's not as true as I thought it was. If I would care if it was bad, for the same reason. Uh-huh. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Well, Mark, I really appreciate talking to you today. Thank you for giving your time. I think people are going to very much enjoy this interview.
Cool. Yeah, it was fun. Thank you.
And next time I'm down there in LA, which is pretty often, I'm very excited to try the donuts.
You have to come by.
Have you heard? There's a new one. I don't know if you pay attention to the donut scene, but there's a new one in Seattle that I've been going to called General Porpoise. Have you heard of that one?
I haven't heard of it.
It's real fancy. It's really interesting. And it's, I don't know how to describe it. I wonder if you'd have thoughts on it, but they only have like four kinds at a time. And it's all a cream filled, like a lemon curd or a vanilla this, something really fancy, expensive. And they're a little bit less sweet. It's like dark chocolate. It's like really kind of fancy stuff. It's by a guy who owns a bunch of fancy restaurants here in Seattle. And it's really good. It's like a new thing. I'm just curious if you had heard of it.
It sounds like there's a place in like the Bay Area called Donut Dolly. And it's all filled donuts. They fill it to order or whatever.
Yeah.
Top Pot is sort of the inspiration for Donut Friend.
I love Top Pot in some ways. Yeah, it's
Top Pot is like classic, really good classic donuts. And like I actually started... All my recipes kind of started with from the Top Pot cookbook.
They have a cookbook? Like, it's not secret?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's like, you know, it's like I bought it or whatever. Yeah. It's like I bought it. When I had the idea for Donut Friend, I went up the coast and I went to all the places I could go, you know, that I knew of. Mm-hmm. Top Pot was definitely on my list. And I really liked their stuff, bought their cookbook, and went home and started making donuts based on their recipes. So I love Top Pot.
Yeah, me too. That's where the one that I get that fluffy cinnamon sugar ring that I like so much is from there.
Yeah.
I'm not eating any sugars and carbs right now, though, and so I took my one cheat day, the one I've had in the last whole month, and said, I'm getting a donut today. So I definitely love them. Can't wait to try yours, and I'll see you next time we're down there.
Awesome.
All right, I appreciate your time very much, Mark.
All right. See you.
All right, see you later. Hey, hang on one second. Reba, could you get a picture? Do you mind if I take your picture on the screen? I'll use this for the episode.
Sure.
I'm going to stand right over here and we'll get a picture of this. Will you just get it from right here? Like as if I had my arm around it or something? That work?
Yeah, it's still dark.
That's all right. Good enough. All right. I appreciate it very much.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Yeah.
That's what ransomware is all about. It's psychological pressure.
Ransomware, when your computer's hacked into and your data held ransom. Attacks are on the rise, and Russian gangs are making billions of dollars.
The moment I got that message, I knew our greatest fears that we ever have are starting to come true.
The post-Cold War era is over.
.com, The Hacking. A new season from Crowd Network with me, Katie Puckrick. Just search for .com, that's DOTCOM, and subscribe.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.